Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, humorist Dave Barry discusses his memoir, Class Clown, The Memoirs of a Professional Wiseass. Dave is interviewed by Mark Baser of The Interview Show. This conversation originally took place May 15th, 2025, and was recorded live at Chicago Hope Academy. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I really want to thank you all for being here, supporting the past, present, and future of American writing with us. And to that end, I'd like to introduce tonight's program. Tonight, we're going to welcome one of America's most well-known humorists, an award-winning columnist, and a truly mediocre rock musician, Dave Barry. Dave Barry has been making America laugh for more than 40 years as a journalist, both in print and online, as he chronicles the antics of Americans in predicaments ranging from national park mishaps to Florida man adventures. He's alienated the state of Indiana, irritated Neil Diamond fans, and informed this country about the dangers of exploding toilets. He's the author of more bestsellers than you can count on two hands, including Swamp Story, Lessons from Lucy, Dave Barry's Complete Guide to Guys, Dave Barry Turns 40, and Dave Barry is not making this up. As someone who grew up in a household reading every one of these books, I want to tell you, it is a great treat to have him here with us tonight. And tonight he will be interviewed by a journalist who last interviewed him in 1997. Mark Baser is the host and executive producer of The Interview Show, a live talk show filmed at The Hideout that ran for six seasons on WTTW. And was syndicated through American Public Television, and is currently available as a podcast. He and Dave have some major catching up to do, so let's welcome them both to the stage. Dave and Mark, come on up.
Oh, stop.
This is such a thrill. One book that wasn't mentioned, Dave Barry Slept Here, your parody of American history books. That my mom gave that to me growing up. And
that's why you ended up not and that's what majoring I believe. In history.
That's what I believe now.
Yeah.
So you've written a memoir, Class Clown, everybody's got it. It's wonderful. And I want to start with near the end of the book, you address book tours. And you write, went on a book tour. Quote, you do many interviews in which you say the same things over and over and over, trying to sound enthusiastic, even though deep inside you're starting to hate your book. Where are we on the timeline?
We're still early. I like the book, but I'm on this ridiculous book tour. I'm just going to tell you the itinerary so you'll get it. I started in Coral Gables, Florida, where I live, went to San Francisco. Went to Phoenix, was there last night, here now, tomorrow, Rhode Island, then Washington, D.C., then, naturally, from there, St. Louis, then Nashville, Tennessee, and then, of course, Seattle, and then Los Angeles, which is very near to where I was 2 days ago, but I'm not going to get back there for a while, so and it's a lunatic tour. But yeah.
But you're near the beginning here, so you don't.
I'm at the beginning, so I'm still into that. But the thing is, you'll do anything on a book tour that you have to do. And you become a complete prostitute for your book. I'll tell a story. It involves Chicago, this story. I was on a book tour. This is like back in the 90s. And I was on a book tour. I don't remember the book, but I remember I was in St. Louis. And I got a call from the publicist who said, the Oprah show. We're just talking about having you on tomorrow. We have to get you to Chicago. You're going to get a call from the producer. So the Oprah, and you want to get on Oprah's show. That was a big deal. So,
for what reason? Not the book club, but a different reason.
It was not the book club because the Oprah. You know, it was good. You know why? Because you could sell books. So anyway, so the Oprah producer calls me and she says the show is going to be. Things we do in secret. See, once I would be on a panel of people, and it was like you were going to confess to something you've done that you're ashamed of that was wrong, and you're going to confess to it and then make it right on the air. That was the theme of the show. So she goes, do you have anything that would be good for that? And I'm thinking, like, I will confess to the Kennedy assassination, you know, to be on Oprah's show. So But I came up with something, which was a few years earlier, I had been a Hyatt Hotel, and in the bathroom, there was a sign. It was like a plastic tent sign. And it said, our guest towels are 100% cotton. Should you wish to purchase a set, they are available in the gift shop for $75. Should you prefer to take the set already in your room, that amount will automatically be added to your bill, which is a nice way of saying if you steal the towels, they'll charge you $75. So I stole the sign because I thought it was funny. So I brought it home and we put it in the guest bathroom. Yeah, it's true. And we had it there for years, and people thought it was funny. So I told this story to the Oprah producer, and she goes, that's perfect, perfect. You'll come on the show, you'll tell the story, you'll drop the sign into a box, and a give-back box. We'll have it on the set, and then we will get it back to the Hyatt Hotel.
Because you're making amends.
Yeah. Okay. You're making it right. So, and I'm great. I'm going to be on the Oprah show tomorrow. And the problem was that the Oprah show was here. I was in St. Louis. And the sign was in Coral Gables, Florida, where I live. So I call my wife and tell her, you gotta express this. I don't care how much it costs. You have to get this sign to the Oprah show. And I gave her the information. But she said, well, they say that they can't guarantee that it will get there. And I'm thinking, like, I'm really screwed here because I have to, this is the Oprah show. And then I realized something, which was that I was staying in a Hyatt Hotel. It is absolutely true, in St. Louis. So I stole another sign. This one, it was a difference. They didn't have the towel sign, but there was a no smoking sign that looked similar. And I thought I could just, nobody will ever know. I'll pull it out of my pocket and drop it, you know, be fine. My point here, you're on a book tour, you'll do any. I was willing to steal again and lie to Oprah and a show about making things right, you know, just because that's what you do on a book tour.
Wait, did it? What happened?
Okay, the sign that was supposed to get there got there, and we were able to return it on the air. And then,
and what about the other sign that
the
you
other
stole?
Sign? I think I threw it away because I was afraid, like, the Hyatt sign police would track me down. You know.
So, one of the cardinal rules of life that you have that you mention in this book is to never take anything too seriously, especially yourself. And yet you've written a memoir, and so there's like a little bit of a tension there. So talk about, why'd you want to do it? Did you initially want to do it? Was there, like, did you have to be talked into writing the memoir? And it's funny, but there are also parts that are not so funny.
Yeah, no, I did have to be talked into it. I was, this was about 2 years ago, I finished a book, and you know, you're thinking, what's the next book going to be? And my agent and editor both wanted, they liked the idea most of a memoir, and they kind of talked me into it. And my fear, my worry, which is I still have, is like, well, who's going to care? You know, like, because my whole thing is I entertain people, you know, which is like, I write jokes, and you see the jokes and you laugh. That's the idea. And this is, and sometimes the jokes are about me, but it's still jokes about me. It's not me necessarily. This is more parts of this much more real about me. And when I was writing it, I was like, that was what they like, I'm not that famous. You know what I mean? When I was writing the book, the big memoir that was out was Barbara Streisand's. She had a 970-page memoir full of famous things that happened to Barbara Streisand. Like, at one point she says, she's on a phone with Warren Beatty, and she hangs up and goes, did I sleep with Warren? I can't remember. Maybe once, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm nowhere near that. I know for a fact that I never slept with Warren Beatty, right? No matter what he says, okay? So, but that was a concern. And, like, the other question is, like, well, do I make this just a whole bunch of jokes? And I didn't really want to do that because then it wouldn't really be a memoir. So I wanted to talk about, my parents. And when I started talking about my parents, I thought, well, My parents are definitely where I got my sense of humor. I definitely want to include them in this. But they were not perfect people, and they did not have perfect lives. You know, so how much do I want to talk about that? So that was an issue that kept coming up for me, and I tried to balance it out, you know, and I hope I succeeded. I mean, the goal I have is, like, this is where the jokes came from. You know, that's so here are the jokes, but also here's why they are there.
Well, to that end, I want, if I can, to quote something that you wrote about your parents, because I think it also, it's a serious chapter about growing up. It's in the beginning of the book. But I also think it's kind of sets the tone for how you approach it. You write, let me just get my notes here. You write, this is about your mom. She was the sharpest and funniest person I knew. I owe much of my personality and all of my career to her. I wouldn't reduce her life to a struggle with depression any more than I'd reduce my dad's life to a struggle with alcoholism. They were both good people, smart, funny, decent people. And I think it's that part, like, I wouldn't reduce her life. Like, and that runs through the book. Like, there are things that are tough. There are things that are heavy. And yet, like, unlike some memoirs, which might deserve it, you don't dwell on it. There is, you take into capacity the full breadth of life.
Yeah. Just to make the simple short version is, my dad was an alcoholic and my mom committed suicide, which sounds awful. It sounds like I had a horrible childhood. And the reason I'm funny is because I had so much pain growing up. That is not what happened. None of that is what happened. My dad was an alcoholic. He was also a wonderful man who changed a whole lot of people's lives, who recovered from alcoholism and helped a whole lot of other people get through it the rest of his life. He was a great dad. And both my parents were great parents. My mom she dealt with depression all her life, but she didn't inflict it on us. I mean, we were aware of it, but in a weird way, what it came out with for us was it made her just this edgy, sharp person who kind of opened a world of humor up to us that I don't think we'd have seen otherwise. Just so you know about my mom, so it was the 50s when I was born in 1947. I was growing up in the 50s in a little town called Armonk, New York, a village, a hamlet, and now it's like a big, you know, New York suburb, Tony suburb. But then it was a little town where everybody knew everybody. And my mom was a housewife. She had four kids. We're growing up, and she's raising four kids. But she was different from the other moms. I mean, really different from the other moms in a way that I loved and savored. For example, we lived in a house in the woods. We had woods all behind our house. We didn't own them, but they were there. You know, we used them. And there was a pond back there. And we used to go play in this pond. When we were little, which is something you would not let your kids do now, right? But in the 50s, they had extra kids. You know, she had four, right? So, like, when we were pretty little, like, my sister, I remember I'm like five, and my sister's like six or seven. Like, I mean, and we're like going out to the pond, and we go, Mom, we're going to the pond. Now, like, a normal mom of that time would have gone, you kids, be careful. You stay away from don't go in the water. You know, that would have been the mom. My mom was, don't drown, kids. And this real June Cleaver, you know, and we go, we won't. You know, we thought that was hilarious.
You tell another story about how there's a saw that your dad had taken from a tool that your dad had taken from the neighbor.
My dad built our house because he had no money. He wasn't very good at building houses, but he built ours. We had a defective house, but it was, and it was never quite finished, but my dad was always borrowing tools, and he borrowed a skill saw, powered circular saw from our next door neighbor, a guy named Tom Schroth, and he was using it to build a house. And Tom got a job as the editor of Congressional, a prestigious job in Washington, D.C., moved to Washington, D.C., and my dad still had the skill saw. And so this set off a years-long correspondence between my parents and Tom Schroth. They loved each other, and, you know, just Tom was like, where the hell is my skill saw, you know, and I want my skill, on his official congressional.
In letters, they'd send
letters. Yeah, it was mailed letters. I put one of the letters in the book, official stationery, you know, where's my skill saw? So my mom, this is so my mom, one day loads my brother Sam, who's 5 years old, into the car, didn't tell anybody she's doing this, loads Sam into the car, it puts a skill saw in the car, and drives from Armonk, New York to Washington, D.C., pounds on the door, Tom Trost's door. He opens the door, and she goes, here's your goddamn skill saw. She did that just so she could do that. You know, that was my mom. And the quote you said, like, you never took anything too seriously in our family. That was really my mom. Never. I mean, she would not let that ever happen. She would never let a chance to make a joke go by. So, like, the day we buried my father, there was a big memorial service in New York, and then there was another big one in Armonk where we lived. A lot of people loved my dad. So at the end of all that, just the family, my sister, my two brothers, my mom and me, go up to the Middle Patent Cemetery, a little beautiful little rural cemetery near Armonk, to bury my dad. We've got his ashes in a box. And it's a rainy, gloomy day. And we get to the cemetery, and we walk to the gravesite, and it's raining, and we put the box in the hole they had dug, and we put the dirt over it, and we all said some words, and we're weeping and talking and weeping and weeping. Finally, it's over. We turn away. We're walking away from my dad's grave. My mom is on my arm. We're both crying. It's raining. My mom looks down and reads the gravestone and goes, "So that's why we don't see him around anymore." Well, that was my mom. Like, and my dad would have appreciated that joke, but she was never going to not make a joke when she could. So
that's great. For you, growing up, which came first, a love of writing or telling jokes?
Telling jokes. I mean, I was elected class clown, Pleasantville High School class of 1965. And it was a fair election, no matter what you've heard. But I was always that kid. I was the kid in the class who just had to make. I mean, I was not good at sports. I was not physically developed. I didn't reach puberty until I was 37 years old. And I needed a way to make the other kids like me, you know. And so I did it like with humor. I got my people, you know. I could make them laugh. And I was a little bit of a discipline problem. I was told more than once by more than one teacher, "That's very funny, but you can't joke your way through life." But which turns out to be not true.
I want to give credit to one teacher, though. One teacher, you, and maybe this is where it started. You were writing, yeah. You were putting funny stuff in, and
yeah, I was okay at writing. I was pretty good at writing for a kid, I think. And I had a high school teacher, Regina Adams. I give her a shout out in the book. Who was a composition class, English composition, and so she liked my writing and would tell me, you know, this is good. And then I started writing things that I thought were kind of funny. My idol was Robert Benchley, so I was trying to write like Robert Benchley. And I wrote a thing toward the end of the year, and she really liked it. She said, "I'd like to read this to the class." And I said, "No, please don't, Mrs. Adams," because, you know, I had carefully cultivated this persona of the wise ass. I didn't want to be the teacher's pet who's, you know, like, I just didn't want that. I didn't want the older boys holding me upside down in the toilet, you know. And she said, "Okay, would you mind if I read it without saying who wrote it?" And I said, "Yeah." And I remember she read it, and they laughed. The kids all laughed at, you know, the right parts that I thought, you know. And I thought, that's pretty neat. That feels pretty good. So that really was kind of the first time I remember writing humor and getting a reaction.
There's a few themes in the book, and one theme that, I don't know if it's a theme necessarily, but that throughout the book is your love of newspapers. And, you know, I mean, we can get into your career trajectory, but you don't start out immediately as a humor columnist.
No.
You do start out as a journalist, and like many journalists, a small town journalist. So what was it that initially, it almost seemed like you got there and you're like, "I found my people."
Yeah, I wanted to write, you know, I was an English major, so I had no useful skills. And I wanted to write, the newspaper seemed a logical place. I mean, if you'd asked me, "What do you want to do?" You know, I would have said I would want to write humor, but it never occurred to me that I could be able to do that. You know, like when I was just getting out of college, Art Buchwald was the king of, you know, humor columnists. And there was, you know, people like Russell Baker, Mike Royko, and Irma Bombeck. I thought that was great, but I wouldn't have ever pictured myself doing what they did. I didn't know how you would get there. But I did know I liked to write, so I got a job at this little newspaper in Pennsylvania, the Daily Local News, Westchester, Pennsylvania, and covered, wrote obituaries, went to fires, police reports, covered all these municipal meetings, that incredibly dull meetings, that are, some of which are probably still going on. You know, just like... And wrote these long stories that I'm sure nobody ever read. But I loved the newspaper, loved it. Just, you know, it was just different. You never knew what you were going to do any given day, go to work, and you never knew when you're going to end up at a fire in the middle of the night. It was just exciting to me.
Can I ask, though, part of being able to write the humor column, this is a mangled way to say the sentence, but do you owe to learning the form that you had to be able to, you can't parody the form until you've learned the form. So writing those stories about municipal meetings.
Yeah, no, that's like that. Yeah, very good point. I contend that when I you know, circled back, finally got back to writing a column. When I went, I started out as a newspaper guy, just purely newspaper guy, and who wrote a few columns on the side. When 10 years later or whatever, I was actually being paid just to write humor columns, I really drew on my experiences my column made a lot of fun of newspapers. Because the newspaper is always like the authority, you know, the columnist is always telling you exactly what you should think about the economy or the Middle East, and the person writing the news story is always, you know, the authority, this is what happened, this is the truth. And I was this complete batshit crazy person writing this column full of lies and ridiculous, but pretending to be an authority. I was mocking the form because I knew that form, because I had written in that form, you know. The truth is, like, newspaper reporters never know what they're talking about. They're just faking it. So I was like more obviously faking it.
So you're writing for the local paper and you become an editor for the local paper, and then one of your columns gets the attention of an editor in Philadelphia. Is that what happens?
Well, actually, by that point I was teaching effective writing seminars. But yes, I'm the big break I had. I was teaching this effective writing seminar. I won't go bore you the details, but I went from the little newspaper to the Associated Press. I hated the Associated Press, so I just quit journalism and was teaching, going around to cities like one of which was Chicago, talking to engineers and accountants and people who didn't write for a living about how they should write. You know, try to get them to stop saying things like "enclosed, please find the enclosed enclosure" and all the stuff. The way business people wrote. And
still do.
They still do. Now they say circle back and stuff like that. But anyway, so I'm doing that, but on the side I'm writing this humor column. I'm in my 30s at this point, and I don't believe that this is my real job. It's a hobby. I'm writing this little humor column on the side. But it, you know, a few newspapers were picking it up, and it was nice. I enjoyed it, and I kept every week, kept doing it. And then the big thing was when my son was born in 1980. And it was a perfect timing because a whole lot of people my age, boomers, had sort of moved up through the ranks in newspapers and they were now becoming editors. So a lot of me, people my age, were starting to run newspaper sections, magazines, whatever, people who decided who was writing for them. And my son Ron was born, and I wrote a column, a long essay, about natural childbirth, which was invented by boomers. There was no childbirth before we came along. At least, you know, the way we are about everything, like, oh, this is buddy. And we had classes, you know, where you learned how to have a baby. Like, I don't know how people did that before with it, you know. But the classes were all about, like, how you deal with the contractions. And they never used the word pain, you know. And they talk about breathing techniques. And you're like, you're in there with all these other yuppies going and learn practice. And then when you get into the actual moment, it's like, it's like none of it works. And it was just, you know, so anyway, I wrote a long essay just kind of making fun of the whole natural childbirth thing. And it was just perfect because there was like 9 million editors around the country who are all having babies with natural childbirth. And so the Philadelphia Inquirer ran it. And it gets circulated immediately to all over the country, a lot of newspapers. And the first call I got was from a Chicago Tribune editor whose name I don't remember, but I do remember the negotiation I had. I had been paid $350 for that essay by the Inquirer, which is the most I'd ever been paid for any piece of writing to that point. He calls me, this editor at home calls me, I'm with the Chicago Tribune, loved your piece in the Inquirer, we'd like to run it in the Chicago Tribune. How much do you charge? And I'm thinking, I've never sold anything. I'm thinking, like, okay, I got $350 already, so this is just gravy. So I go, well, how about $50? And there's pause, and then he goes, we pay $500. To this day, I figured if I'd said $25, he might have gone up to $1,000, you know. But that launched it, and then from that moment, I was on the radar of a bunch of editors around the country, one of which was the editor of the Miami Herald. And pretty quickly after that, I started getting my stuff in more and more papers, and I got hired by the Miami Herald full-time to just write whatever I wanted to write, humor. So I went from, like, teaching effective writing seminars, and I'm expecting that to be my entire career, to suddenly I have the best job in American journalism. I can write whatever I want. And
you're coming up, and you're doing it at a golden age for newspapers. And nothing, I think, illustrates this. And this is a story I think people in Chicago will appreciate because there's a similarity here. Where the New York Times does a hit piece.
Yeah.
A hit piece. They do a story, hit piece, on Miami. And they talk about how much crime and how bad Miami is.
Yeah, the New York Times discovered in 1986 that Miami had drugs and crime. And they sent this, like, it was so Timesy. They sent this, you know, New York Times people are all the same. But anyway, they very serious, self-important journalists come down, a big team, and they interviewed, like, discovered that.
They do this to every city.
Yeah. And like, we're aware that we had drugs and crime in Miami. By now, I'm living in Miami. And so they ran this big story on the front page of the magazine, Can Miami Save Itself? A city awash in drugs and crime, you know. The clear answer was no, you know, Miami can't. So at Tropic Magazine, where I worked at the Miami Herald, we thought, well, okay, they've done us this courtesy of coming down. Why don't we go up and see if there's any problems in New York? And so we sent me and a photographer. They had a whole team. We just me and a photographer named Chuck Fadley. And we went up there and spent like 3 days. And just, I wrote the most vicious hit piece ever in the history of hit pieces about New York, which I was able to do. I used to live in New York, so I felt very comfortable, you know, with the steaming hell that was the subway system and everything like this. And we ran that story. And when you say golden age, we wanted to run on the cover the Long Island garbage barge, which maybe that rings a bell, I don't know, was this kind of big problem they had. New York had produced all this garbage. It was on this barge, and they were trying to get rid of it, and nobody would take it, and it went all the way down to Venezuela and came back, and it was just this famous garbage barge. It was like a celebrity. It was on the Phil Donahue show. I'm not kidding. Phil did a show about the Long Island garbage. So we really wanted that to be the cover, like this emblem of what, you know, New York just totally screwing up something. And we couldn't get Chuck wanted to get a picture of it, and we couldn't get the right angle from the land. We spent like hundreds of dollars on cabs just driving all around the harbor, Brooklyn, trying to find it, a good angle for it. Couldn't find it. We finally said we had to rent a helicopter. And we go over to New Jersey, and we rent a helicopter, and we didn't even ask permission from our editors. You know, it was $8,000, you know, to take a picture. And the helicopter, I said, you want what? Yeah, okay. And we go take this picture, and today you couldn't spend $8 for a newspaper. The newspapers don't have any money anymore. But back then we could just waste it, and that's probably why they went out of business. Now that I think of it.
You brought up your son, also a journalist, and there is an incredible story in the book.
Oh, yeah.
You win the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
And there's a photo that's published everywhere. You tell the story of you.
I won a Pulitzer Prize. One of the stories I won it for was the Can New York Save Itself story. That was part of the package that went up to the judges. But I didn't know that I'd won. In fact, and this is not false modesty, I did not ever think I would ever win a Pulitzer Prize. The category is distinguished commentary. Like nobody has ever. Right? See? So, like, I still think they're going to come around and take it back someday. Like, but anyway, I didn't expect it. And so the Herald was going to surprise me because the Herald found out the morning of the announcement was made at noon, they found out I was going to win and they wanted me there for that. But that same day, I was going to go to Key West with my son, Rob. And he was very excited about this because when we would go to Key West, I would rent a motorbike and he would get in the back and we'd just ride all over the island. That was like one of his favorite things to do. So he's all excited. We're going to Key West. And I get this phone call from my editor, the Herald, saying, you have to come in to a meeting. And I go, I can't. I'm going to Key West. No, they want you here for this meeting. It's very important. So I tell Rob, okay, we got to go to the Herald, but then we'll go to Key West. So we go into the Herald. Everybody's gathered around the newsroom for the announcement, the Pulitzer announcement. And I still don't know that I've won one. And I'm like, oh, look at this, Rob. Okay, we're going to see the... And it was me and another guy, won a photographer named Michael DeSeal, won the other, Harold won two Pulitzers that day. And so we're waiting, just waiting, and an editor who didn't know that this was supposed to be a secret comes up to me and goes, congratulations. And it's like, I realize I'm about to win a Pulitzer Prize, but I also realize that we can't go to Key West. So I said to Rob, we're not going to Key West. And his face fell, and then I said, but I'm going to buy you a Nintendo. Because he'd been bugging me for a Nintendo, and I said, and he goes, really? Oh, yeah. And then he jumps up and gives me this huge hug. And at that moment, they announce that I've won a Pulitzer Prize, and they take a picture of this moment. So then the next day on the front page of the Herald, there's a picture of Michael DeSeal getting congratulated by his colleagues. And then there's me. As the Herald wins two Pulitzers, there's me, and Rob's got his arms around my neck and this huge smile. And all my friends said, you know, the best part of all was how excited Rob was that you you won a Pulitzer Prize. He had no idea. Just to finish that, though, he is now an editor at the Wall Street Journal, and he's won a Pulitzer Prize. So there you go. Yeah. For factual
things. You should have recreated the photo. Hmm? You could have recreated the photo.
I don't think he wanted any part of that. No, I'm saying,
You devote a chapter, and rightfully so, to your readers, which I loved, and there's... There's probably more, but there are two types that stand out of readers. There's what you call alert reader, somebody who everybody knows, who sends you in stuff and fed a lot of the material that would end up being in the columns. So I want to talk about those, but then there's also, I don't know what the name for the reader is, but somebody who sends you gotcha letters.
The haters. Yeah. the correctors. Everything I wrote was usually full of lies and inaccuracies. And there are people out there, I call them the humor impaired, who just can't process the idea that you might be kidding. And so if you write, like, I wrote a column once that said, I went to France and I wrote a column about it. I said, among the sights to see in Paris are the Louvre, the Arc de Triomphe, and the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And so, you think an obvious joke. You not believe how much mail I got. Mr. Barry, before you call yourself a travel expert, you should do a little research because... The Leaning Tower of Pisa is located in Italy, which not in France. And and I love those letters. And all of those people, I wrote them all back. The ones at least who had given me return addresses, I wrote them all back. And I said, you are mistaken. The Leaning Tower of Pisa was moved to Paris in 1973. And one lady, Mrs. Herbert Harder of Denton, Kansas, wrote me another letter saying, I check with my travel agent. And I said, you can't win. But so like that was always fun for me, was the people correcting me, but also the people just plain hating on me. I got the best hate mail. Hate mail is actually kind of good if you're a columnist because you can use it. But if nothing else, it can be entertaining. My favorite single postcard that I ever got, which I reproduce in the book, I'd written a column about Christmas carols that I did not care for. And this postcard said, I haven't read one of your columns since you shit on the little drummer boy. And never will. Because I'm not a fan of that particular song. For one thing, it goes on for almost 2 hours. For another thing, like just the premise of it, the idea this woman has just given birth to a child, that somebody comes in with a frickin' drum... And there's other little things about the song I don't like. The ox and lamb kept time. How did the ox and lamb keep time? All right, ox and lamb, anyway, so, and also just, not that I'm dwelling on this, but drums don't go rum-pum-pum-pum. They go rat-a-tat-tat.
But I am surprised that you kind of like the hate mail. I know so many writers who say, I only remember the nasty letters. I don't remember the praise.
But in this case, and I did get some of that, and those do hurt more when it's just really just viciously personal, but it's when they're just missing the point completely.
Yeah, those are good.
It's kind of fun. Or like, okay, I got maybe the most hate mail I ever got for any one thing I wrote is when I wrote And this was not the point of this column. It was just a one line in it. I wrote that maybe Neil Diamond, and I just want to stress, I love Neil Diamond. Neil Diamond's a genius, okay? But they maybe could have done a little better with the lyric where he goes, "I am, I said, to no one there, and no one heard it all, not even the chair."
That's bad.
Like, no shit, Neil. I mean, probably the table didn't pick up on it either because these are pieces of furniture. So I got hate mail. But there's some real... You think Salman Rushdie got in trouble? I mean, you know, too soon, right? Too soon.
No. Perfect. You hit it on the right day. Yeah.
But I mean, a lot of people really love Neil Diamond, and like, how dare you? He's a genius, Mr. Barry, and he changed my life. I listened to Heartlight 14 times, and it cured my goiter, Mr. Barry. And so you know, like that. So I wrote a whole other column because that was great.
That's
for
good.
Me. Like, yeah, okay. And I wrote a column about the Neil Diamond people, and then that just set it off. I mean, there's all these people, because a lot of people agreed with me about that song. This is an issue people care about in this country. And then I ended up writing a whole book about songs people hate because of that one little remark.
Amazing. Let's talk about what people do care about, and without trying to, like, without us sounding too old here, there is, and you addressed it in the book, and I want to start with, you wrote a column about the Anita Hill, Justice Thomas hearings, which obviously are not funny, right? The accusation, nothing is funny about that, except for what your column did was skewer the windbags in the Senate who are running the hearings. And yet, as I read, and you preprint some of the column, as I read it, I kept thinking, that's not something that you joke about anymore.
No,
you
don't, yeah.
Because even though the joke is about the senators, we've kind of got to the point. And I'm just curious about your thoughts on
political correctness and wokeness.
Or political humor, I guess, more.
Yeah, no. I think the pendulum may be swinging back a little bit, but it went pretty far in the direction of, no, but you can't make a joke about anything. If anybody's offended, it's bad. And like, and I honestly, you can't write a joke that's not going to offend somebody.
Did that ever go through your brain? Like, I hope I'm not hurting somebody. I hope.
No, I can't say that I was as sensitive maybe as I was supposed to be, but I generally didn't pick targets that I thought of as helpless,
right,
you know?
Right.
Neil Diamond, I guess.
Yeah, he's doing fine.
But
well, you did make fun of people from Indiana.
They kind of asked for it. there's another one's column. You find out who's insecure. The column was about which was the stupidest state. Somebody had done a study of the stupidest state. Indiana was not chosen as the stupidest state, just for the record. I argued very much my state, Florida, should win that one, you know. We took it like a month to figure out who we voted for president in 2000. But I did mention some other states that, you know, like, were not necessarily brilliant. And one of them was, I just said Indiana, like, you know, here's a state where they have a nickname, the Hoosiers, and nobody knows what it means. And it could mean, said, for all we know, it could mean has sex with caribou, you know, and it's an Indian word. So, like, most of the other states were just fine. Indiana, man, I got hundreds of letters saying everyone knows what Hoosier means. And it was like 117 different definitions.
But you are right.
My favorite guy who really got me from Indiana was, for your information, Mr. Barry, there are no caribou in Indiana. So they're off the hook for that.
And oddly, or ironic, I think you are right that nobody knows where that...
No, I mean, somebody may, but I'm telling you, I could show you the letters. There's no general agreement about what it means, you know.
This is not an old age question, but are there columns that you've written that you looked back on when you were doing the book and don't remember writing?
Oh, yeah, many.
And I think we've all had that with things that we've done in the past. Like, are you like, that's pretty good? Or you're like, whoa.
It depends. Generally, I'm like, that was okay. Sometimes I actually thought, well, that's pretty good. And sometimes I thought, that one's not so good. So, you know.
What do you think, not specific necessarily to your work, but it's something that I've thought about a lot, is like, what is it, what humor do you think lasts? In other words, you could watch a Charlie Chaplin movie, perhaps, and think that's super funny. Or you could read a Shakespeare play that's supposed to be a comedy, and you could think, I think you've joked about that before. Like, I don't wear the jokes. Like, what do you think allows certain comedy or humor to endure? And did you think about your own work in that way? You're writing a newspaper column. It's people are throwing the newspaper out.
Yeah, I really don't think of humor as being very enduring. My idol when I was a kid, I got my sense of humor from my mom, and I got my sense of what kind of column I wanted to write from a guy named Robert Benchley. Yeah. My dad was a fan of Robert Benchley. He had his books. He was this guy who wrote columns in the 20s, 30s, 40s. He was a member of the Algonquin Round Table, a brilliant guy. And I loved the way he wrote. He was just so smart and so silly. He didn't ever try to make a point. He was perfectly content to start one place and end up with a different subject. And I just loved that because I was used to kind of the plotting humor that we were given in school. This is funny. This is by Thomas, Jonathan Swift. And it's hilarious because there's one joke in it, which is they're eating the babies, satire. And like, I came to my thought, satire is humor that is not funny.
Salman Rushdie, Jonathan Swift, you're going
I wasn't a fan of Jonathan Swift, so yeah. or most of the humor that I was told was
funny.
But
at one point, people probably did find
right,
that.
Right, exactly. This is where I'm going. So Robert Benchley, I loved him. I read him as a kid. I have all his books. I still sometimes pick them up. It's harder and harder for me to understand the humor because it's very related to the culture he was in, which is almost 100 years ago now. So almost all the references to show business or music or whatever, products, they're no longer, I know that is also true of me, that the columns that I wrote in the 70s, I can see already, like, they're like the picture in Back to the Future that's slowly fading away. All those references aren't going to mean anything to anybody. So I'm very confident, and this is doesn't bother me, that my humor is not going to last. It's not going to hold for the most part.
Do you have a goal beyond making people laugh?
Nope. I really never did, and I still don't. It kept me from ever being disappointed in myself. I just wanted to make people laugh. I wanted to entertain. And sometimes people will go like, but Dave, you do make some points sometimes. I go, no, I don't. That's on you if you got a point out of that. Or people will say, this has really helped me. Or your humor really helps people. And I go, yeah, but I would do it even if it hurt them because it's really the only skill that I have.
Is there a point that it's all just absurd, don't take things too seriously? Is that a overarching point?
Yeah, that's close to it. I mean, there are obviously things you can never make a joke about, but in a way there aren't.
Yeah.
It just depends who you're making it to and how you're making it. But there, you can't, to a broader audience, make jokes about certain things. But most of the time, all I'm ever doing is taking something that people are talking about seriously and saying, well, it's really not that serious, is it? That's really it.
Is there, and this we can then segue perhaps into your thoughts about where media or newspapers can go, but is there a place still for a humor column?
No, unfortunately, because there is no space anymore. The newspapers are disappearing. The space is gone. They don't run many columns anymore. Used to have big, pages of columns in newspapers. Now they don't. They can't afford to hire a column. I don't think that's trendy anymore. But what I did, and which was what Art Buchwald did and Irma Bombeck did, was, write 500 to 800 page word essays, humor essays. There's very little of that going on. There are still really, really funny people, but they're more likely writing memes. There are some really funny memes, but they're just a different, medium. There are people who are very funny on, we call it X, on X. And there are wonderfully funny people doing stand-up. There are wonderfully funny people, writing movies and TV shows. But what I did, not so much. Substack, some.
Yeah, that's true.
Some.
What about the attitude, attitude might be the wrong word, in general, toward this amorphous thing called the media, toward mainstream newspapers? Like, do you lament that fact that people coming to your column are coming almost in a sense of, like, not that we're going to believe what you write, although some people obviously did, but we're going to trust this guy, that he's on our side, that we're all on the same side of, I think at one point you talk about debating over politics, and everybody at one point basically agreed that everybody wants to take care of their children and have good lives. And now, of course, society seems to have been ruined. But but take that back, if you can, to just... Do you see a way out for the media? Do you see a way out for the media to regain people's, I think you used the term in the book, confidence?
No, not an easy way. We're going to get really serious here, I fear, but I don't want to get serious. But
we can go back to, what was your favorite booger joke?
No, I think we kind of blew it, the media. We're already on the ropes just for economic reasons. And when Donald Trump came along, a lot of the political reporters, you know, who had up to that point, I thought, generally, everybody knows newspaper reporters lean left, but I think had done a pretty good job. I know a lot of political reporters did a really good job of trying to be fair. And I think too many people in the media decided it was their role to stop Donald Trump. That's fine, but you can't do that and say that you're an objective observer of what's going on. If people can sense that, and they did, you just lose their trust. And it's really hard to get it back. And I think that's what happened to a lot of the political media in this country.
And the arguments.
And they were being attacked unfairly, yeah, also at times. You know, Trump's never been fair to the media particularly. But that doesn't justify, you know, giving up your professionalism. And I think we did too, yeah, much. Too many people did. And it really hurt. And it still hurts. And I feel bad about that, because I loved my profession. I wrote about covering politics with all these political reporters over the years.
And all the conventions.
Yeah, all the conventions and all the times of the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primary. I just loved all that stuff. But it's really difficult now to argue that we didn't deserve to lose people's trust, to me.
Well, let's end on a more triumphant note. You did one of the greatest things, and I remember it, and it's in the book. Can you talk about how you got back at the telemarketers?
Yeah. I had the best readers. They were like an army of people just ready to commit acts of mayhem on my behalf. Back in, trying to remember the year, it was like the early 2000s, I think. The telemarketing industry was just going berserk. People were getting all these phone calls at home. People still had more landlines then. And there was this bill in Congress to stop that and make it so that they could not call you at home if you didn't want to be called. And the American Teleservices Association, which is their main trade organization, fought that, just fought it vehemently and argued that they had a constitutional right to call you at home. So I wrote a column that said, well, they're arguing that they have a constitutional right to call you at home, and, you know, do they or don't they? How do you feel about this? Tell me. No, wait. Tell them. Here's the phone number of the American Teleservices Association. And that ran on the weekend. And there's a story 2 days later in the New York Times that said the American Teleservices had to shut down their switchboards because after a columnist in Miami printed their name. And they were really unhappy that they were inconvenienced.
That's the best part. That is the best part.
By getting all these calls. So you imagine how bad I felt about that. But anyway, they're probably still pissed off. But anyway.
Well, the book is absolutely wonderful. Hopefully everybody will pick it up. And you're doing a signing afterwards,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
at that table right there. The book is Class Clown. Everyone, Dave Barry.
Thank you. How about this guy?
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.